The most recent investigations showed that these stones must have been exposed to a heavy radioactive bombardment and high temperatures in the very remote past. Sumerian cuneiform tablets show fixed stars with planets. In Russia, archaeologists discovered a relief of an airship, consisting of 10 balls arranged in a row next to each other, which stand in a right-angled frame supported on both sides by thick columns. Balls rest on the columns. Among other Russian finds, there is a small bronze statue of a humanoid being in a bulky suit which is hermetically closed at the neck by a helmet. Shoes and gloves are equally tightly attached to the suit. In the British Museum, the visitor can read the past and future eclipses of the moon on a Babylonian tablet. Engravings of cylindrical rocket-like machines, which are shown climbing skywards, were discovered in Kunming, the capital of the Chinese province of Yunnan. The engravings were on a pyramid which suddenly emerged from the floor of Lake Kunming during an earthquake. How is anyone going to explain these and many other puzzles to us? When people try to dismiss the old traditions wholesale as false, erroneous, meaningless and irrelevant, they are merely dodging the issue. It is equally unreasonable, when all is said and done, to lump all translations together as inaccurate and then make use of them when it happens to suit one's purpose. I think that there is something cowardly about stopping one's eyes and ears to facts, or even hypotheses, simply because new conclusions might win men away from a pattern of thought that has become familiar. Revelations take place hourly and daily all over the world. Our modern means of communication and transport spread discoveries all round the globe. Scholars of all disciplines should inquire into the reports from the past with the same creative enthusiasm that they bring to contemporary research. The adventure of the discovery of our past has finished its first phase. Now the second fascinating adventure in human history begins with man's moving into the cosmos. Chapter 10, The Earth's Experience of Space. The question whether space travel has any point has not yet been silenced in discussion. The partial or total meaninglessness of space research is supposed to be proved by the banal assertion that people should not poke around in the universe so long as there are still so many unsolved problems on Earth. As I am anxious not to enter into the realm of scientific argument unintelligible to the layman, I shall only give a few obvious and valid reasons for the absolute necessity of space research. From time immemorial, curiosity and the thirst for knowledge have always been the driving force for continuing research on the part of man. The two questions, why did something happen and how did it happen, have always been the spur to development and progress. We owe our present-day standard of living to the permanent unrest that they created. Comfortable modern means of transport have removed the hardships of journeys which our grandfathers still had to suffer. Many of the rigors of manual labor have been noticeably alleviated by machines, new sources of energy, chemical preparations, refrigerators, various household appliances, etc., have completely liberated us from many activities that formerly could only be done by human hands. The creations of science have become not the curse, but the blessing of mankind. Even its most terrifying offspring, the atom bomb, will turn out to be for the benefit of mankind. Today science reaches many of its goals with seven-leagued boots. It took 112 years for photography to develop to the stage of a clear picture. The telephone was ready for use in 56 years, and only 35 years of scientific research were needed to develop radio to the point of perfect reception. But the perfecting of radar took only 15 years. The stages of epoch-making discoveries and developments are getting shorter and shorter. Black and white television was on view after 12 years research, and the construction of the first atom bomb took a mere 6 years. These are a few examples from 50 years of technical progress, magnificent and even a little frightening. Development will continue to reach its targets faster and faster. The next 100 years will realize the majority of mankind's eternal dreams. The human spirit has made its way in the face of opposition and warnings. in the face of the archaic writing on the wall saying that water was the fish's element and air the bird's element, man has conquered the regions which were not apparently intended for him. Man flies against all the so-called laws of nature, and he lives underwater for months in nuclear-powered submarines. Using his intelligence, he has made himself wings and gills which his creator had not intended for him. When Charles Lindbergh began his legendary flight, his goal was Paris. Obviously, he was not really concerned with getting to Paris. He wanted to demonstrate that man could fly the Atlantic alone and unharmed. The first goal of space travel is the moon. But what this new scientific-cum-technical project really wants to prove is that man can also master space. So why space travel? In only a few centuries, our globe will be hopelessly and irremediably overpopulated. Statistics already calculate a world population of 8.7 milliards for the year 2050. Barely 200 years later, it will be 50 milliards, and then 335 men will have to live on 1 square kilometer. It doesn't bear thinking about. The tranquilizer-like theories of food from the sea or even cities on the floor of the sea will prove inefficient remedies against the population explosion sooner than their optimistic supporters would like to think. In the first 6 months of 1966, more than 10,000 people, who had tried in desperation to keep themselves alive by eating snails and plants, starved to death on the Indonesian island of Lombok. Youthant, Secretary General of the UN, estimates the number of children in danger of dying of hunger in India at 20 million, a figure which backs up Professor Molyarov's claim that hunger is reaching for world domination. It has been proved that world food production does not keep pace with the growth of the population, in spite of the most modern technical aids and the large-scale use of chemical fertilizers. Thanks to chemistry, the present age also has birth control products at its disposal. But what use are they if the women in underdeveloped countries do not use them? For food production could only draw level with the population increase if it were possible to halve the birth rate in 10 years, that is by 1980. Unfortunately, I cannot believe in this rational solution, because the sound barrier of prejudice, ostensibly due to ethical motives and religious laws, cannot be broken through as quickly as the calamity of overpopulation grows. Is it more human or even divine to let millions of people die of hunger year after year than to save the poor creatures from being born? Yet even if birth control were to win through one fine day, even if cultivable areas were enlarged and harvests multiplied by aids as yet unknown, even if fishing supplied much more food and fields of algae on the ocean bed provided nourishment, if all this and a lot more were to happen, it would all be only a postponement, a putting off of the evil day for about 100 years. I am convinced that one day men will settle on Mars and cope with the climatic conditions just as the Eskimos would do if they were transplanted to Egypt. Planets, reached by gigantic spaceships, will be populated by our children's children. They will colonize new worlds, just as America and Australia were colonized in the comparative recent past. That is why we must press on with space research. We must bequeath our grandchildren a chance to survive. Every generation which neglects this duty is condemning the whole of mankind to death by starvation sometime in the future. It is no longer a question of abstract research which is only of interest to the scientist, and let me impress on anyone who does not feel that he is responsible for the future that the results of space research have already protected us from a third world war. Has not the threat of total annihilation prevented the great powers from settling opinions, challenges and conflicts with a major war? It is not necessary now for a Russian soldier to set foot on American soil in order to transform the USA into a desert, and no American soldier need ever die in Russia, because an atom bomb attack makes a country uninhabitable and barren owing to radioactivity. It may sound absurd, but the first intercontinental missiles guaranteed us comparative peace. The view is occasionally put forward that the billions invested in space research would be better spent on assisting development. This view is wrong, The industrial nations do not give aid to underdeveloped countries purely on charitable or political grounds, they also give it, understandably enough, to open up new markets for their own industries. The aid that the underdeveloped countries require is irrelevant from a long-term point of view. Approximately 1/6 milliard rats, each of which destroyed about 10 pounds of food a year, were living in India in 1966. Yet the state dare not exterminate this plague, because the devout Indian protects rats. India also has a population of 80 million cows, which give no milk, cannot be harnessed as draft animals, or even be slaughtered. In a backward country whose development is hindered by so many religious taboos and laws, it will take many generations to sweep away all the life-endangering rites, customs and superstitions. Here, too, the means of communication of the age of space travel, newspapers, radio, television, serve progress and enlightenment. The world has become smaller. We know and learn more about each other. But to arrive at the ultimate insight that national frontiers are a thing of the past, space travel was needed. The resulting increase in technology will spread the realization that the insignificance of peoples and continents in the dimensions of the universe can only be a stimulus and incentive to cooperative work on space research. In every epoch, mankind has needed an inspiriting watchword that enabled it to rise beyond the obvious problems to the apparently unattainable reality. A quite considerable factor which provides an important argument for space research in the industrial age is the appearance of new branches of industry, in which hundreds of thousands of people who lost their jobs through rationalization now earn their living. The space industry has already outstripped the automobile and steel industries as a pace setter in the market. More than 4,000 new articles owe their existence to space research. They are virtually byproducts of research for a higher goal. These byproducts have become an accepted part of everyday life without anyone giving a thought about their origin. Electronic calculating machines, mini transmitters and mini receivers, transistors in radio and television sets, were discovered on the periphery of research, and so were the frying pans in which food does not stick, even without fat. Precision instruments in all aircraft, fully automatic ground control systems and automatic pilots, and last but not least the rapidly developed computer are parts of the space research that has so many persecutors, parts of a development program that also have an effect on the private lives of individuals. The things of which the layman has no idea are legion: new welding and lubricating processes in an absolute vacuum, photoelectric cells and new tiny sources of energy conquering infinite distances. Out of the flood of taxes which is poured into space research, the returns on the vast investment flow back to the taxpayer in a steady stream. Nations that do not participate in space research in any way will be overwhelmed by the virulent technical revolution. Names and concepts such as Telstar, Echo, Relay, Trios, Mariner, Ranger and Syncom are signposts on the road of irresistible research. Since terrestrial supplies of energy are not inexhaustible, the space travel program will also become vital one day, because we shall have to obtain fissionable matter from Mars or some other planet in order to be able to illuminate our cities and heat our houses. As atomic power stations provide the cheapest form of energy already today, industrial mass production will only be fully dependent on these stations when the Earth no longer yields fissionable matter. Fresh consequences of research overwhelm us daily. The leisurely transmission of acquired knowledge from father to son is over forever. A technician who repairs a radio set that works by simply pressing a button must know all about the technology of transistors and complicated circuits that are often printed on sheets of plastic. It will not be long before he also has to deal with the tiny new components of microelectronics. What the apprentice is taught today, the journeyman will have to fill out with new knowledge. And even if the man who was master of his craft in the days of our grandfathers had knowledge to last his whole life, the master of the present and future will constantly have to keep on adding new skills to old. What was valid yesterday is obsolete tomorrow. Even though it will take millions of years, our sun will burn out and die one day. It does not even need that terrible moment when a statesman loses his nerve and sets the atomic annihilation apparatus in motion to cause a catastrophe. An unascertainable and unpredictable cosmic event could bring about the Earth's downfall. Man has never yet accepted the idea of such a possibility, and it may be for that reason that he devoutly sought the hope of an afterlife of the spirit and soul in one of the many thousand religions. So I suggest that space research is not the product of his free choice, but that he is following a strong inner compulsion when he examines the prospects of his future in the universe. Just as I proclaim the hypothesis that we received visits from space in the dim and distant past, I also assume that we are not the only intelligence in the cosmos. Indeed, I suspect that there are older, more advanced intelligences in the universe. If I now also assert that all the intelligences are carrying on space research on their own initiative, I am really moving into the world of science fiction for a moment, knowing full well that I am putting my head into a hornet's nest. Flying saucers have been cropping up on and off for at least 20 years. In the literature on the subject, they are known as UFOs, the abbreviation of their American name, unidentified flying objects. But before I deal with the exciting subject of the mysterious UFOs, I should just like to mention an important argument used when a justification for space travel is under discussion. It is said that research into space travel is unprofitable. No country, however rich, can raise the enormous amounts of money needed without risking national bankruptcy. True, research per se has never been profitable. It is the products of research that make the investment profitable. It is unreasonable to expect profitableness and the amortization of research into space travel at its present stage. No balance has been struck to show the return from the 4,000 byproducts of space research. To me, there is absolutely no doubt that it will give a return such as has seldom been given by any other kind of research. When it reaches its goal, not only will it be profitable, it will also bring the salvation of mankind from downfall in the literal sense of the word. Incidentally, I may mention that a whole series of Kazmat satellites are already sound commercial propositions. In November 1967, Der Stern said, "The majority of medical life-saving machines come from America. They are the product of the systematic evaluation of the results of atomic research, space travel and military technology. And they are the product of a novel collaboration between industrial giants and hospitals in America, which is leading medicine to new triumphs almost daily. Thus the Lockheed Company, which makes starfighters, and the famous Mayo Clinic cooperated to develop a new system of nursing based on computer techniques. The designers of North American aviation, following suggestions by the medical profession, are working on an emphysema belt, which is intended to make it easier for patients with lung trouble to breathe. The NASA space authorities produced the idea for this diagnostic apparatus. The apparatus, actually conceived to measure the impact of micrometeorites on spaceships, registers minute muscular spasms in certain nervous diseases." Another life-saving byproduct of American computer technology was the pacemaker. Today, more than 2,000 Germans live with one of these apparatuses in their chests. It is a battery-driven mini-generator which is introduced under the skin. From it, the doctors insert a connecting cable through the superior vena cava to the right auricle of the heart. The heart is then stimulated to rhythmical movements by regular surges of current. It beats. When the battery of the heart machine is burnt out after 3 years, it can be changed by a comparatively simple operation. General Electric, the American concern, improved this little miracle of medical technology last year when it developed a two-speed model. "If the wearer of this pacemaker wants to play tennis or run to catch a train, he simply moves a bar magnet up and down for a moment over the spot where his built-in generator is located. His heart promptly works at a higher speed." So much for the report in Der Stern. Two more examples of byproducts of space research. Who still has the nerve to say that it is useless? Under the headline "Stimulus from Moon Rockets," The newspaper Die Zeit contained the following report in its edition number 47 of November 1967. The designs of space vehicles developed for soft landings on the moon have an interim interest for automobile manufacturers, for the knowledge of how such designs behave under conditions which cause their destruction can be appreciably increased. Even though it will not be possible to make cars safe for the passengers against all kinds of collisions, the designs used with most success in space travel can help to diminish the risk when collisions occur. Honeycomb sheets, which are being used more and more in modern aircraft construction, guarantee high tensile strength with little weight. They have also been practically tested in automobile manufacture. The floor of the experimental gas turbine-driven Rover car is made of honeycombs. Anyone who knows the present state of research and the impetuous way in which it develops can no longer tolerate sayings such as it will never be possible to travel from one star to another. The younger generation of our day will see this impossibility become reality. Gigantic spaceships with incredibly powerful motors will be built, as the Russians proved in 1967 when they succeeded in coupling two unmanned spacecraft in the stratosphere. One sector of space research is already working on a kind of protective screen, like an electric arc, which is attached in front of the actual capsule and is intended to prevent or deflect the impact of particles. A group of distinguished physicists is trying to detect what are known as tachyons. As yet, these are theoretical particles which are supposed to fly faster than light and whose lower speed limit is the speed of light. Scientists know that tachyons must exist. It is now only a question of providing physical proof of their existence. Yet such proofs have actually been produced by neutrinos and antimatter. Finally, I should like to ask the die-hard critics in the chorus of opponents of space travel, do they really believe that several thousands of probably the cleverest men of our time would waste their impassioned work on a pure utopia or a trivial goal? So let me tackle UFOs boldly, ignoring the risk of not being taken seriously. If I am not taken seriously, I can at least console myself with the knowledge that I am in distinguished company. UFOs have been sighted in America and over the Philippines, in West Germany and over Mexico. Let us assume that 98% of the people who claimed that they had seen UFOs actually saw ball lightning, weather balloons, strange cloud formations, new unknown types of aircraft or even odd effects of light and shade in the sky at twilight. Undoubtedly, too, many people were the victims of mass hysteria. They claimed to have seen something that simply was not there. And of course there were also the publicity seekers who wanted to make capital out of their alleged observations and produce banner headlines for the press in the silly season. If we reject all the crackpots, liars, hysterics and sensation mongers, there still remains a sizable group of sober observers, including people whose jobs make them familiar with celestial phenomena. A simple housewife may have made the same mistake as a farmer in the Wild West. But when, for example, a sighting of UFOs is made by an experienced airline pilot, it is hard to dismiss it as humbug. For an airline pilot is familiar with mirages, ball lightning, weather balloons, etc. The reactions of all his senses, including his first-class vision, are regularly tested. He is not allowed to drink alcohol for some hours before takeoff and during flights. And an airline pilot is hardly likely to talk nonsense, because he would lose his nice, well-paid job only too easily. Yet when not merely one airline pilot, but a whole group of pilots, including Air Force men, tell the same story, we are bound to listen to it. I myself do not know what UFOs are. I do not say that they have been proved to be flying objects belonging to unknown intelligences, although there could be little objection to such a supposition. Unfortunately, I have never seen a UFO with my own eyes during my worldwide travels around the globe, but I can reproduce here some credible, authenticated accounts. On 5th of February, 1965, the American Department of Defense announced that the Special Division for UFOs had been instructed to investigate reports of two radar operators. On 29th of January, 1965, These two men had made out two unidentified flying objects on their radar screen at the Naval Airfield in Maryland. These objects approached the airfield from the south at the enormous speed of 4,350 miles per hour. 30 miles above the airfield, the objects made a sharp turn and quickly disappeared out of radar range. On 3 May, 1964, various people at Canberra, Australia, including three meteorologists, observed a large, shining flying object crossing the morning sky in a northeasterly direction. During an interrogation by delegates of NASA, the eyewitnesses described how the thing had tumbled about in a strange way and how a smaller object had rushed at the large one. The small object had given off a red glow and then been obliterated, while the large thing had disappeared from view in a northwesterly direction. One of the meteorologists said resignedly, "I've always ridiculed these UFO stories. What the hell am I going to say now?" On 23 November, 1953, an unidentified flying object was picked up on the radar screen of the Kinross Air Base in Michigan. Flight Lieutenant R. Wilson, who happened to be on a training flight in an F-86 jet aircraft, was given permission to chase the thing. The radar crew watched Wilson pursuing the unidentified object for 160 miles. Suddenly, both flying bodies merged with one another on the radar screen. Radio calls to Lieutenant Wilson were unanswered. During the next few days, the region in which the inexplicable event took place was combed for wreckage by search troops and nearby Lake Superior was examined for traces of oil. They found nothing. There was absolutely no trace of Flight Lieutenant Wilson and his machine. On 13 September, 1965, shortly before 1 in the morning, Police Sergeant Eugene Bertrand came across a distracted woman at the wheel of her car in a bypass at Exeter, New Hampshire, USA. The lady refused to drive on and claimed that a gigantic gleaming red flying object had pursued her for 10 miles to Route 101 and then disappeared into the forest. The policeman, an elderly level-headed man, thought the lady was a bit crazy, until he heard the same report from another patrol over his car radio. Speaking from headquarters, his colleague Gene Talland ordered him to return there at once. There a young man told him the same story as the lady had done. He too had sought refuge in the ditch from a glowing red object. Rather unwillingly, the men went on a car patrol, convinced that the whole silly story would have a rational explanation. They searched the district for 2 hours, then they set off on the return journey. They passed a field in which stood six horses that suddenly stampeded madly out of it. Almost simultaneously, the region was bathed in glowing red light. "There! Look there!" shouted a young policeman. Indeed, a fiery red object, which moved slowly and silently towards the observers, was floating above the trees. Bertrand excitedly informed his colleague Talland over the telephone that he had just seen the damned thing with his own eyes. Now the farm near the road and the neighboring hill were also bathed in glowing red light. A second police car screeched to a halt next to the men. "God damn it!" stuttered Dave. "I heard you and Talland yelling to each other over the radio. I thought you'd gone crazy. But just look at that." 58 qualified eyewitnesses came forward during the investigation of the mysterious incident that was subsequently carried out. They included meteorologists and members of the Coast Guard, in other words, men who, as reliable observers, were scarcely likely not to be able to tell a weather balloon from a helicopter, or a falling satellite from the navigation lights of an aircraft. The report contained factual statements, but did not give any explanation of the unidentified flying object. On 5 May, 1967, the mayor of Malines in the Côte d'Or, Monsieur Malliot, discovered a strange hole in a field of clover 680 yards from the road. He found traces of a circle with a diameter of 15.5 feet and a depth of 1 foot deep. Furrows 4 inches deep ran out in all directions from this circle. They gave the impression that a heavy metal grating had been pressed into the ground. At the end of the furrows there were holes 1 foot 2 inches deep, which might have been impressed in the soil by feet at the end of the metal grating. An exceptionally curious feature was the violet-white dust which was deposited in the furrows and holes. I have inspected this place near Marlene's personally. Ghosts could not have left those traces. What are we to make of this account?